So I want to thank the organizers for allowing me to speak. And I'm going to be presenting some work that's in progress with several people here, with Czaslav and Esteban and Rob, as well as Alessio, Magdalena, and Constantino, on enhancing entanglement with this quantum temporal switch. So just to give some brief introduction, I'm sure most of you are familiar what is indefinite causal order is. But we think there may be one. Quantum physics may admit a causal structure where the order of events is indefinite. So that's one reason we're interested in this. We also have seen that it provides advantages in computations and communication efficiency, channel capacity, and it's not known how this indefinite causal order or this indefinite temporal order will affect entanglement of quantum fields, in particular, this entanglement harvesting from quantum fields. Why do we care about entanglement harvesting? So those qubit field interactions, they can non-destructively be probed using entanglement harvesting. It can also be used to probe the entanglement structure of quantum fields in various space-times, for example, such as near a black hole. If you see how detectors become entangled in certain places, that can shed some light on what is going on in that field that they're interacting with. It can be exploited for seismology and range finding. So in particular configurations, the entanglement of these detectors is very sensitive to small differences in their separation distance, and that can provide that can be exploited for seismology or range finding. So that's just a very brief overview of these two quite interesting topics that I'm going to hope to combine today. So what is entanglement harvesting, and what is this UNRDOIT model that I will be mentioning? So the entanglement harvesting protocol is, in general, three steps. You begin with two uncorrelated particle detectors. They could be atoms, qubits, harmonic oscillators, and you allow them to interact with some free quantum field, and they interact locally. So they interact where the detector is. Here we're going to take our quantum field to be a massless scalar field in the vacuum state. This doesn't always have to be the case, but it's interesting to note that there is entanglement in the vacuum state to begin with. Now, after this interaction, they interact for some finite time, and after this interaction, the detectors are entangled. Even if they remain space-like separated through this whole interaction, even if they can't signal, there's still entanglement. And that's because there was entanglement in the field to begin with that they interacted with. So the entanglement has been swapped from the field to the detectors. Now, what are we using as a detector? In this entanglement harvesting protocol, we usually use this UNRDOIT detector model. The UNRDOIT with a detector with a scalar field is a reasonable approximation for the light-matter interaction when there's no angular momentum exchanged. This here is an UNRDOIT detector, just a two-level system, a qubit, with an energy gap given by omega. The particle detector, because we say that a particle has been detected when the detector transitions from ground to excited. It goes click, there was a particle there. Another reason that these are interesting and this UNRDOIT model is interesting is I'm just going to sort of make this note right here that we can't measure fields directly. We measure how things respond to those fields, and I say things in general. So we don't directly measure light. Our eyeballs see light. It causes some interaction in our eyeballs, and that's transmitted to our brain, and we say, hey, we see light. Or we measure photon counters, which again, that's the response of some detector to a field. So it's just kind of reminding, I just like this because it's sort of, when we're measuring quantum properties of the field, we're looking at how something responds to that field, and it's a very operational way of looking at properties in that field. So how do we couple the detector and the field? Through this interaction Hamiltonian here. This is the coupling strength. It's going to be small because we'll take perturbative expansion later on. The switching function. So we allow this interaction to the detector to couple and then uncouple to the field. This is the monopole moment that just encodes the degrees of freedom of the detector. And then here is the field. It's smeared out over what we call the spatial profile of the detector, so where the detector is in space, and here's the field operator. Tau is the, in general, the detectors don't attempt the same proper time, so tau is the proper time of the detector. From everything else, we're going to assume that the detectors have the same proper time. They're sitting stationary in flat space, but I wanted to show you what this interaction Hamiltonian looks like in general. So, step one, initialize field in the vacuum state, and the detectors are in the ground state. We're going to evolve it under our time evolution, and which can be expanded in the interaction strength perturbatively like so. But this doesn't have to be expanded. The final state is just given by u rho u dagger. And then to see what the detectors look like, we just trace out the final state of the detectors. And in general, it will look like this state here. Now, how do we create? So we've taken the field, the detectors, initialized it in the ground state, let it interact with the field for some time, and now we want to measure its entanglement. So to go, eventually I'm here, we use the concurrence, and here's just some motivation of why we use it. The entanglement formation, it is a measure of entanglement of this bipartite rho IB state, where it has the interpretation of the number of Bell pairs that you would need in order to prepare this rho IB using local operations in classical communications. So it's a pretty reasonable measurement of entanglement, and you can have a good picture of what it means. It's given by this fairly complicated expression here, h of this, where h of x is this expression here, and this script c is the concurrence, which is also an entanglement monotone. For a detector, for a density matrix of this form, the concurrence takes on this expression, but perturbatively it takes on a much more simpler expression that I'll show later on. So we're going to use the concurrence as our measure of entanglement. Now, what do I mean by indefinite temporal order? We have the freedom of choosing when the detectors are turned on and off, if you remember that interaction Hamiltonian. So why don't we condition this switching on some control qubit? Where the measurement of I determines where the switching is centered for both A and B. Now we initialize the field detector control in this state here, so the detector is initially in the plus state and everything else is in ground. And the new interaction Hamiltonian looks like this, where I've just assumed that the proper time of the detectors are the same. So, and this extra term here, that's how the control talks to the qubits, talks to the detectors. Now, let's consider two scenarios. We're going to call them, the first one is cause and effect. So not always space-like separator detectors are in superposition of A before B and B before A. Now, if they're space-like separated, how do we know that which one is first, A before B or B before A? Well, we can imagine them in this configuration, and if we moved B closer to this way, then it would be within the light cone of A. So you could actually say that they signaled A could be before B or B could be before A. And we could just smoothly increase their separation to get to this state here. It's just some nomenclature. So this configuration we call cause and effect. And just to kind of make some things clear, red is one branch, black is the other. And if you remember those switchings later on to get to this configuration, we could say TA0 equals TB1, so A0, B1, and B0 equals A1. Or there's another consideration, past-future, where they both are on in some past, or they're both on in some future. Of late or early. Again, A, B, branch late, or branch early, and branch 8. Again, these are in a superposition, so in any one branch of the superposition, they're both on once. And these are distinct scenarios. So you could think if they're spaced like separated, you could slide, you could do some Lorentz transformation to move them around. But you can only move one, you could only make one branch look like one. So for example, one branch of the cause-effect superposition look like one branch of the past-future case. So if you notice that both of these cases, the black are along some space-like surface, but the other branch, the red branch, are very clearly in a different situation. So if that doesn't cause any huge confusion, again, stop me if there's questions.
So were all space-like separated in both scenarios?
Yes. They don't have to be, but I'm just presenting the space-like here. You could move, well, in particular, the cause and effect. You could move these close, B closer to A and have direct signaling along one branch. Or signaling between the branches, however that makes sense. So first, I'm going to present some perturbative results. Perturbatively, to the lowest order in the interaction strength, you have your final state of your detector control system looks like this. And there's three things now you could conceive of doing with your control. You could measure it in the computational basis, you could throw it out, or measure it in the plus minus basis. There, of course, would be other things you could do, but I think these are kind of the sensible ones. Now, if you measure in the plus minus basis, where I is now either 0 or 1, your final state of the two detectors, it looks like this. And this is just your standard entanglement harvesting. So nothing particularly interesting here. You've set when the detectors turn on and off. They've definitely turned on and off there. And you end up in just with standard entanglement harvesting. Now, if you just threw out your control without looking at this, you're gonna be of this form, which you can see is just a mixture of both of the two branches, a probabilistic mixture of the two branches. Now, and then the third one is if you measure on the computational basis, you end up like in this form. Now, what's interesting is these PAs and LABs, they sort of take all four terms, whereas the M, that's the same as it was before. It's just the 0, 0, and 1, 1. But in all cases, the density matrix has the same form, something like this. And if you were to trace out the first qubit, you could see that these PAs, PBs are indeed the transition probability of each detector. This M, we say, that encodes the non-local correlations. And this LAB encodes the total correlations. And to the lowest order in the interaction strength, the concurrence is now this. And hopefully this will show why. One of the reasons that we like the concurrence, and that is it just takes a simple form twice, M minus PA minus PB square rooted. Now, this is true regardless of whether the detectors are the same or not. And you can see it looks like, well, we say the detectors are entangled. When this is non-zero, when the non-local correlations are larger than the local noise. Yes?
Can you go back one slide, please?
Yep.
How do I understand that it's to the fourth order?
Each of these are order lambda squared.
Each detector has lambda squared?
Each of these terms is to order lambda squared. Only even terms survive. Because otherwise you're going to have, you can't have an odd number of creation and annihilation operators.
So for your Hamiltonian, director Hamiltonian, you keep it to which order?
You keep it to lambda squared, I believe.
So you ignore the higher order?
You ignore the higher order terms.
Okay.
And this is what you get to lowest order. This term right here becomes non-zero at order lambda
to the
four.
To the second order.
Why do we keep that? Because that's the lowest order.
If you keep only lambda, the Hamiltonian to the lambda order, there's nothing.
There's nothing at. I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question.
In the direction Hamiltonian,
yes.
We expanded in the series in lambda.
Yes.
And I suppose some calculations in the detectors use only the first order term.
But you don't get on
the those are zero.
You need entanglement, so you have to
see. So that's the lowest order that you see.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you were to expand out this unitary, you get lambda, lambda squared, but there's one of these on each side. Uh-huh. And when you trace out the field, you end up with, you know, zero, a bunch of creation annihilation. You get an expectation of a bunch of creation operators. You need to have an even number of those.
And if the first order is zero effect.
First order is zero because that just is going to have one creation or annihilation. And I guess one more thing to point out here, this looks like it could have a negative eigenvalue, but that eigenvalue that would be negative is actually order lambda to the 4. So you would need, and once you include all of the terms to that order, this is a proper density matrix. The eigenvalues are non-zero or are positive. That's just another note. So remember this formula. I will write it down when it's useful again, but this is our measure of entanglement. We take these detectors now. We're going to make them point-like. So we're going to say that they interact just at one point in the field. And we're going to turn them, we're going to let them have a cosine switching. So, which is nice because it's a compact switching function. If we cut it off at these, we cut it off. So it just is one half of a cosine. And we're going to say they have identical gaps, which is set to 1 in units of sigma.
And it doesn't work in more dimensional spacetimes, right?
Sorry?
It doesn't work in more dimensional spacetimes than 1 plus 1.
No, this isn't 3 plus 1.
But in compact switching, you have singularities then, right?
In 3 plus 1?
Yeah, if you have compact switching function, then the detector breaks down in 1 plus 1 space, in 3 plus 1 spacetime, right?
We didn't see singularities. I think...
if you have compact switching function, you have to have smooth switching function to avoid singularities, right? I mean...
Well, this is smooth in the sense that it's, you know, part of a cosine.
It's smooth enough.
Is it smooth enough?
Yeah.
I thought you need a Gaussian at least or something. No.
No. If you want to do things analytically is where the Gaussian becomes useful. But we're going to take this cosine and we didn't, numerically, this was stable. I think that's probably a better way of answering your question. If there are singularities, they're very tiny and were suppressed in the numerics. So now to show you the results. So you've got entanglement enhancement. We've taken these detectors, we've interacted them with this control qubit, and here we just throw that qubit out, and here we measure in the plus minus basis and get plus. And the green lines here, they mark space-like separation. On the bottom axis, we have detector separation S. And we've got the time delay t, so that's sort of the maximum distance between the two times. Now, you can see very clearly that when you are measuring in, when you have this cause and effect, you have a lot more entanglement than you do when you just trace out a qubit. In particular, you have entanglement in space-like separated regions. And that's here. So there's significant enhancement of entanglement, and you can see this in these space-like separated regions here. Of course, this is just to lowest order in lambda. So if you can recall, I told you this is important, that concurrence or measure of entanglement is of the form m minus, p, minus root mean squared of the transition probabilities, and m plus, or cause and effect, is the same as the trace. So what's going on here? It turns out that when you have probabilistic mixture, your transition probability is always lower than or equal to this superposition. And that's true perturbatively to the lowest order, but it's true for any spatial profile or switching. So, and these cross terms, if you can remember, probably should have wrote that down here. These cross terms here those reduce the transition probability of the detector. Now, that's where this becomes a work in progress, ongoing work. I don't have a really good interpretation of why this is. This is just mathematically the case. But it comes down to these sort of self-interaction cross terms. Yes?
Could you go back one slide? Yeah. You say there's an enhancement.
Yes.
What scenarios are you comparing?
I'm comparing, so this cause and effect. So you've got a superposition of A before B and B before A in a certain sense, with a mixture of A before B and B before A.
You have coherence and incoherence.
A coherence and...
Which is which? Sorry.
Sorry?
Which is which?
So this is the coherent superposition, and this is the probabilistic mixture.
So the coherent is post-selected on one particular
yes.
outcome of the...
Yeah.
And you're not... So the green line makes space-like separation.
Space-like separation.
Inside of this column, it's space-like separation?
Yeah, inside here.
And you have a time-extended smearing.
Yes.
And so how do you decide on, like,
it's
no overlap for this region of smearing.
Yeah.
It's called space-like separation.
Yes. So you've got a point-like detector, so it has no spatial extent. And you've just got, so it's just basically a Gauss, has some extent in time. And if there's no overlap in their light cones, then they're space-like separated.
And if there is overlap, there are, like, different degrees they can overlap.
There are, but we just take a hard line. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. Like, if you're right there, you're less, you have less overlap than you're here. But we just take a hard line. They're either separated or they aren't. That's why we chose a compact.
That these red regions are...
These red regions are lots of entanglement harvested?
This is time-like separation.
Yes, in here is time-like.
So you're talking about time-like entanglement.
I am, except for these little regions right here. So the black dots, I didn't mention that, the black dots are zero entanglement. So all of this black region is zero, and all of this is zero, but they've got these regions of a very small amount of entanglement harvested, but in a non-zero.
And this field, is it the massless field?
Massless scalar field, initialized in the vacuum.
So is mass is essential to this?
These calculations, I'm not really sure what would happen if you turned mass on. So it's massless from the beginning.
It gets worse.
Probably. You get another cutoff. Is that good? So, here, what's going on is your local noise or your transition probability of the detectors is being reduced by being in this coherent superposition. Now, I'm sure some of the people here are asking, at least in their heads, what about double switching? What if I took the switching function to actually just be the average of on, off, so of this form right here? Is that perhaps these effects are just caused by a double switch? So if you go through and crank through the calculations, you find that, yes, indeed, the transition probabilities, these non-local terms, they're the same as the double switch. Or sorry, the total correlations are the same. But the non-local terms are different. They now pick up these cross terms, whereas when you had a coherent superposition, these cross terms weren't present. And what's even more interesting, and again, another question that I have in interpretation, is this non-local term is actually the average of the non-local term if you had this cause and effect superposition and this past-future superposition. So something strange is going on here. There's two, but I also don't want to understate the fact that the state of this detector, the two-detector system, is in a different state if it was in a double switch than if it was in a coherent superposition. And even more interesting, the only way you could actually get to that information is if you looked at the entanglement of the detectors. If you looked at, say, its mutual information, that cares about these total correlations and the transition probabilities, you wouldn't be able to get to the difference between the two states. And then just to sort of hammer home, this is now the same coherent superposition you saw before, and now this double switch. And yeah, they look very different. But what's even more, but also you still don't have this space-like entanglement harvesting. So can we go beyond perturbative? We can if we take now the switching functions to be some delta. So now the switching function, now they switch in just one point in space, but now we need to give them a spatial profile to avoid divergences. And we take the spatial profile to be a Gaussian so that we can, everything here can be calculated analytically. Now the final state of the detectors is of this form. It's known exactly. You can write it down. It's just a page long. Each of these terms is very long. But it's known exactly. There is this theorem by this no-go theorem of entanglement harvesting. So if you have a pair of underduet detectors, you give them any kind of spatial profile you want, any kind of coupling strength you want, and you interact, and they have delta switching, so they interact at just some point in time, they cannot harvest entanglement from a coherent state of the scalar field. Vacuum state's a coherent state, so regular detectors, any shape you want, delta switch cannot become entangled. But we can cheat this. What you see here is the two different situations. On this side, we have the cause and effect, so A before B and B before A. Now, in each branch, they interact only once. And here, past and future superposition. There's entanglement harvesting going on here. We're cheating it. We're getting around this because even though they're on in one branch, in some sense, they're on twice. And also note that these detectors are time-like separated. I've given them a very wide spatial profile, so they're overlapping to like well out here. They're sitting on top of each other. But although if these were not in a superposition, if they were in a mixture, or if they were just in early or just late, there would just be black dots everywhere. They could not get entangled. So now the conclusions are this indifferent temporal order, this quantum switch, it enhances entanglement harvesting, particularly in regions of space-like separation. It reduces the transition probability of the detectors, at least in the perturbative case, I can state that precisely. It's distinct from double switching, and in the perturbative case, you need to see that. You can only see that if you look at the resultant entanglement of the two detectors. And it allows us to get around this no-go theorem and harvest entanglement with delta switching. So, thank you.
Okay, so we have questions. Start with Tim.
So you say it enhances the entanglement harvesting. Unless I missed it, you didn't compare measuring in the computational phases versus measuring in the superposition.
You're right, I didn't. So I'll just go all the way back to, well, this slide right here. The detectors are identical, which ends up meaning that this is the same as measuring in the computational basis. It's going to be the same. So for example, if A goes before B or B goes before A, because they're identical detectors, that's going to end up with the same final state. So if you average two things that are the same, you wind up again with the same thing.
So, all right, but it is possible to space-like harvest with detectors that are just not in a superposition. Like
yes, it is.
So what? Is it you?
It doesn't. That doesn't.
Parameters in such a way that.
It seems to be, and I don't want to make this exact because I haven't looked at the entire parameter space, but it seems to be easy to find regions where you can get space-like separated if you take Gaussian switchings.
Okay.
and it seems to be hard to find regions where space-like separate, or where a space-like entanglement harvesting is possible if you have compact switching.
I see. But then by putting in superposition, you can
get it. It's easier to find. And if you just look at sort of the structure of the formulas, the entanglement is always greater than, because this is the same in both cases, and this is reduced or equal.
Okay, so can you go back to the density matrix?
Which one?
Slides. Where you had all the so I understand you compute amplitude of transition in the second order, then you compute density matrix and truncate everything to the second order, right? That's what you do? So you have second order
yes.
amplitude, right?
But
then if you compute probability, you get fourth order, and then you remove all the terms that have higher than second order, right?
No, we go to second
so,
order.
So the p's here have the fourth order as well?
No, these are to second order.
But you compute amplitude to the second order first, or not?
I don't understand.
So probability of the amplitude, when you compute it, it has the second order, right?
Okay.
In lambda, that's correct. When you compute probability, you get the fourth order.
No, the probability is the second order.
Can you go back and one slide more? The amplitude is.
I just want to go back to here.
The ideology is the density matrix, right?
Yeah, but you have to first compute probability of transition and then take a square of it,
no,
right?
You can compute it directly from here and then.
Yeah, that just gives probability
just gives,
of transition. If you traced over.
If I traced over. I'll just go to this one, for example. If I traced. So this is for AB. If I traced out B, I'd wind up with 1 minus PA.
Yes,
PA.
And P is in the second order in lambda. Right?
Yes, and that is your transition probability.
But does it include the second order perturbation to you, or is it the square of the first order?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Maybe we can talk about this after, so we can write things down and speak the same language. I'm just sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
I mean, it's
okay, there's a comment back there maybe from John.
It's a totally different question.
Sorry. All right. The short answer is it's consistent second order expansion. But Alex, do you chop? Why don't we go to your question?
Yeah, so I wanted to step back to the technical stuff and ask something more conceptual. So from the name, like entanglement harvesting is in a well-worn tradition of thinking about entanglement as a resource that we can use. Particularly interesting is this idea of the vacuum as a kind of entanglement resource lying around for us to use. But something which I don't understand very well is where does the entanglement, the vacuum, come from? And is it kind of if it's a resource, is it a renewable resource? Like, what if we just keep harvesting it? What will happen?
So I can answer a couple of questions. I guess the first one to answer is, where does it come from? The vacuum state, it's a global state of the field. And so it's a global state of the field. Now you interact these detectors locally, which means, and so a global state is a pure state, but if you look at local regions, there's going to be entanglement between those regions. I don't know if that answers where the entanglement comes from.
Well, I guess I had in mind a bit of, like, there's a bit of tension between theorists thinking about the vacuum as something that's just there, whereas experimentalists typically have to do a lot of work to create a vacuum. So there's, you know, practically speaking, there may be a certain amount of work that you have to put in to produce this resource that maybe, from a theoretical point of view, I'm wondering if we're ignoring or neglecting some of that.
Well, in some sense we are. I'm saying the vacuum state, there's no excitations anywhere in space-time at all. It's just these two qubits and the field. Nothing else, not a single excitation anywhere. That's what we're neglecting. And then in terms of renewable, so this model doesn't have back reactions. If you do perturbatively, there's no back reactions in the field, or so this detector getting excited doesn't back react and change the field in any sense. So if you do it perturbatively and the detectors don't back react, it's going to be renewable forever because you're neglecting these higher order terms that will build up. And I know there's been work done in, I believe, so this might not be 100% correct, but my memory, if I recall, if you do this entanglement harvesting in a cavity, so you keep sending these qubits through, eventually your cavity is going to thermalize, and you're not going to be able to extract anymore if you keep sending them through as pairs.
Right. But the amount of entanglement between separated regions is infinite, actually.
Sorry?
The amount of entanglement between two separated regions is infinite. It's not finite, as that result that you just mentioned suggests.
Okay, right, but these detectors are qubits, so they're you can only
know,
have so much.
Could, yeah.
I mean, the entanglement always has to be defined with respect to some operations you're doing, right?
If you take finite cavity and slice it in half,
yes.
That creates entanglement between
between those two regions.
The amount of that entanglement is infinite. So you may not be able to extract that infinite amount of entanglement by using your detectors, but the amount of entanglement in the field is infinite.
Okay.
I think that statement needs qualification.
So if you
are you thinking about in terms of like some area law?
If you get a finite cavity and slice it in half,
yeah,
just introduce some extra murons in the middle, then you create entanglement between modes of the both halves. And if you quantify that entanglement, it's infinite.
Because there's infinitely many modes, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
you can
future,
use
you have a new vacuum and a new vacuum forever.
Yeah.
It's just infinite.
It's all infinite. That's one of the reasons. I mean, that's one of the reasons these detectors are nice. They're just a single qubit, a single bit of information. They're not all the modes at once.
They help you quantify the extractable entanglement. As Laura said, the example of the cavity, eventually you run out of the ability to extract. So whether it's infinite or not, in some sense, is secondary. Right, it's a bit like the infinite energy in the vacuum. You can subtract it off in flat space. When you have gravity, of course, then all bets are off. Any other questions?
Maybe something for a discussion later. So do you think, you're considering this either the control of switching before and later or the double switching? Kind of general interpretation questions. So do you think there is a difference between saying I have a detector that is switched on for a certain time or saying that I have a detector that is switched on at a superposition of different times?
Yeah.
It seems that the two things, like when you have two doubles of switching, I'll be tempted to interpret as I have a superposition of switching before and after.
Yes.
But then if I want to describe it as a detector that is switched on for a certain time, I also use an integration over a certain time. So do you have some idea?
I think it comes down to sort of this expression here, if I'm not mistaken. So if you have a single detector and it's on now or on later in a coherent superposition, at least perturbatively, you're going to end up with something that looks mathematically like this. This you're going to have the same transition probability as if it was on now, off, and then on later.
In your case, the difference is, isn't it that it's a superposition that
you think about it at all?
Yeah, it's both on now and both on later.
At one time, or both being on different
Yeah,
time.
So my question was if there is any difference between superposition and just switch on, off, on.
Yeah, there is.
Not for a single
detector, not perturbatively.
Okay, perturbatively, I see. Perturbatively.
Perturbatively, it's the same.
I see.
Two detectors can tell the difference.
Okay. I see discussion is starting, and it's already 5 after 12. So why don't we thank Laura again?